Here's a look at our headlines this hour. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro lauds the Hamas support for Caracas despite U.S. sanctions and threats, saying the two countries will sign a 20-year cooperation roadmap during his visit. Iran's foreign minister condemns Israel's attacks against Syria as violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. Plus, Lebanon slams the presence of an Israeli drilling vessel in their disputed waters, calling it a violation of its sovereignty and a clear act of aggression. Thank you for joining us. Venezuela's president, who is visiting Iran, says Tehran and Caracas are on the forefront of the campaign against colonialism and imperialism. Nicolas Maduro made the remark in an exclusive interview with Iran's Spanish-language news channel, Hispan TV. Maduro also said his country will sign a 20-year cooperation plan with Iran. He announced the opening of a weekly flight from Caracas to Tehran. He added that the two countries have supported one another in hard times. He said it was indeed courageous of Iran to send oil to Venezuela despite U.S. sanctions and threats. Maduro also talked about the Palestinian cause, calling it the humanity's most sacred struggle now. The Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran on Friday for a two-day visit. Author and journalist Arnold August joined us earlier to explain why the Venezuelan president's visit to Iran is significant.
During the height of the American sanctions against Venezuela, the Iranian government courageously sent several tankers over a period of 1 or 2 years in order to assist the Venezuelan oil industry to kickstart itself. So this is just what is happening today, is a continuation of this extremely important bilateral relations between Venezuela and Iran. I think it has, you know, there's a lot of important points. I cannot, just today, regarding this summit in the of the Americas, Daniel Ortega, representing the Nicaragua government, said in his country what many people perhaps were thinking but not say out aloud, as he did. And he said one of the reasons that Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua were excluded from the summit by the United States was as a result of these three countries, their close ties with Russia in the current situation. I guess indirectly it's also because of how these three countries together are working in order to try to push against U.S. hegemony in this very important period of world history.
Iran has strongly condemned the latest Israeli missile strikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, vowing to stand by the country's government and people. Iran's foreign minister says the Israeli attacks against Syria or against Syrian infrastructure are illegal under international law and violate the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also says the silence of the international community and regional organizations on the issue is regrettable and shameful. He made the comments in a phone call with his Syrian counterpart. Faisal Maqdad also said Israel's hasty acts of aggression are a sign of its fear and weakness. Maqdad said the regime vainly seeks to prop up remnants of terrorist groups in Syria. He said, however, that Israeli attacks strengthen the resolve of the Syrian government and nation to fight occupation and terrorism. Members of the MKO terrorist group attacked for the second straight day an exhibition held in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, on the crimes committed by the group. The MKO agents tried to stop the event by ripping down the banners of the exhibition. Police made some arrests. The organizers of the exhibition say police refused to provide better security for the event despite vandalism by the MKO members. Agents of the terrorist cult mobbed the exhibition on Thursday too, tearing down the banners and splashing paint on them. They violently assaulted the reporter and accompanying news team of Press TV, as well as other participants. The notorious group launched a campaign of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly in the 1980s. The group is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity. We've asked some Swedish citizens what they made of the MKO and its crimes. Let's have a listen.
It's really amazing that they are using, that they used the former Iraq weaponry and so on against their own people. It's like a civil war, and it's, of course, it's a principle of treason against your own country, obviously. Regardless of what kind of ideology or policy you want to make within the country, to do things like that is it's against the principle of you have an obligation to your own country, regardless on what are your personal political beliefs.
If a bunch of Swedish people, they go to your enemy country and attack back your country and your people by all kind of crimes, what would you think about them?
Yeah, well, that obviously is treacherous behavior. It wouldn't be good. But I believe that Sweden already today are run by traitors. So at the moment, there is not much to defend.
You know those people, they are standing here. What would you call them if they was a Swedish people that help your enemy to attack back your country?
Enemy against their own people.
Would you let them to control your country as your government?
No, never.
Would you call them your people anymore?
No, because they have made a choice. They are not with my people then. Exactly like it is for you now. They take a stand against their own people.
People across Iran have joined Muslims in other countries to condemn blasphemous remarks by two Indian ruling party officials against Prophet Muhammad.
We do not tolerate anyone insulting our beliefs, our imams, our country, and our values. We stand against anyone who insults us.
A centerpiece of the protests was the gathering outside the main campus of the University of Tehran. There, the protesters held banners and chanted slogans to denounce the sacrilegious comments about the Prophet's private life. India's ruling party has suspended one of the officials behind the insults and has expelled the other, insisting it respects all religions. But that has not calmed the protests, both in the country and abroad. On Friday, demonstrators rallied in Pakistan's Lahore to demand that the government take stronger action against India.
The government should have boycotted all Indian products. There needs to be a response to India in a way that the future generations will also know that a line is crossed when the Muslim's prophet is insulted.
In India, Muslims staged demonstrations in many areas, including New Delhi, to call for punishment of the officials. Clashes erupted with the police in at least two cities. Authorities also shut down the internet in the Indian-administered Kashmir and declared a curfew, while also banning all congregational prayers at mosques. Similar protests were held in Bangladesh, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Lebanon says the presence of an Israeli drilling platform in disputed waters is a violation of the country's sovereignty and a clear act of aggression against it. The comments were made by the head of Lebanon's technical military delegation in maritime border negotiations with the Israeli regime. In an interview with Iran's Al Alam News Network, Bassam Yassin said Lebanon had been monitoring the Israeli ship since it set sail from Singapore until it reached Palestinian waters. The Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone between Israel and Lebanon at the weekend. It prompted furious reactions from the Lebanese government, with Prime Minister Najib Mikati warning of an escalation. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, also says it is ready to take action, including the use of force against Israeli gas operations. Lebanon and Israel, which have no diplomatic relations, have been holding indirect talks brokered by the U.S., for close of 2 years to resolve their maritime border dispute. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh tells us more about Hezbollah's stance on the dispute with Israel. She says the movement has compared the dispute with Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon and has called on people and officials to be united. Here's more.
It seems Hezbollah is eyeing the situation quite closely. And what we have from Hezbollah right now is a quite official statement from its side. Of course, they said they will not take part. They will not interfere in any of the demarcation process. But he also called on the officials to be united. And he also called on the Lebanese people to be united behind this national cause, which is very significant. He compared this new phase that Lebanon is entering right now to the 1982 Israeli invasion, which reached the capital Beirut. So this is quite significant when it comes to what the nation is looking at right now. We're looking at natural resources that could be looted at any moment, even if the ship does stand in disputed areas, not in areas that are Lebanese, but they have the capability to basically suck out all the natural resources that are across the coastal line of Lebanon. Now, the ship that reached near the field of Karish is UK-based, as you mentioned, but it's also owned by a Greek Israeli. So that also gives Hezbollah leverage. Of course, he had clearly warned that ship that they need to leave the area, that as long as this is called disputed by the Lebanese government, then therefore they should not have the right, just as Lebanon does not have the right.
The fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take a heavy toll on the U.S. economy. U.S. stocks fall sharply as the country's inflation surges to a new four-decade high record. The New York Stock Exchange saw Dow Jones Industrial Average, the broad-based S&P 500, and the tech-rich Nasdaq Composite Index all tumble. It came after the Labor Department said the Consumer Price Index surged by 8.6% in May compared to the same period last year, which is unseen since 1981. This figure exceeded all forecasts. This comes as gasoline prices are hitting records every day in the U.S. as the war in Ukraine drags on. Prices also continued to rise last month for a range of other goods, including housing, groceries, airline fares, and vehicles. While the Russian and Ukrainian army fight over control of Severodonetsk, Jenny Miller reports on the targeting of schools by the Ukrainian army.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens, and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximise casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
An audit released by the state of Florida recently suggests that information that the state released to the public during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic was inaccurate and incomplete. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading State Audit Reveals Florida Undercounted COVID Deaths by Thousands. Here's the story. An audit released by the state of Florida on Monday, June 6, suggests that information that the state released to the public during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic was inaccurate and incomplete. The report conducted over the past year by the Florida Auditor General examined the state's COVID-19 response from March to October 2020. The audit reviewed a sample of tests from three separate state-run facilities in its investigation and ultimately came to the conclusion that data on case and death counts frequently went unreported and that the state often failed to adhere to protocols regarding the virus. state contracted labs, for example, failed to return results for around 60% of the tests that were administered during that 8-month period. Of the results that were returned, many didn't include critical demographic information. Failing to record a person's ethnicity 60% of the time and failing to account for their race more than half of the time. Auditors also found that the state didn't conduct contact tracing for 23% of the positive cases it identified. Put another way, close to 1 in 4 Floridians who tested positive for coronavirus during the early months of the pandemic were never told they had the virus in their systems, the audit concluded. Even when people were notified of their positive results, many weren't alerted until well after they got tested, in some cases more than a week later. The audit also found that Florida officials had undercounted deaths in the state. More than 3,000 additional COVID-19 related deaths were reported by physicians than were on the state's official list of total deaths during the first 8 months of the pandemic. The Florida Auditor General also said in the report that the state failed to conduct routine checks on data collection to ensure accuracy in their numbers. When discrepancies were found, there was no follow-up, the report said. The conclusions in the report confirm that many Floridians were warning about early on in the pandemic, when Governor Ron DeSantis and other right-wing lawmakers were claiming that businesses and other entities were safe enough to reopen despite instituting few statewide precautionary measures to address the continued presence of coronavirus. In the first year of the pandemic, for example, the state restricted local medical examiners from publishing their own numbers on COVID-19 deaths after their numbers conflicted with the state's official reports. A state employee named Rebecca Jones, who was in charge of updating infection numbers across the state, was fired after she alleged that the numbers were being manipulated. DeSantis frequently downplayed the dangers of the virus and even made campaign materials that were critical of national health officials who implored people to take the pandemic more seriously. The U.S. state of Florida is currently seeing an increase in case numbers, reporting nearly 10,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day over the past 2 weeks. More than 74,700 Floridians have died due to coronavirus since the pandemic began more than 2 years ago, a figure that's equivalent to the entire population of Daytona Beach.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, narrates that his illustrious ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, when asked by a person on the rights of the father upon the son, said, "He should not call his father by name. He should not walk ahead of him. He should not sit until his father has seated himself. And he should not do such acts as a result of which people abuse his father.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-purification as agent of development. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-purification as the agent of self-development. When we look at the human body, we see that, of course, in the same way as the body is forced to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions like eating, like earning. So we go out, we work hard, and maybe we sacrifice the sleeping time. Maybe we are sacrificing the time that is being used for the rest. Maybe someone is sick or ill, or maybe he has a headache. And even with all those things, he goes to the work. Why? Because he knows that he needs to earn. He needs to bring some money. He needs to have some sustenance. And in order to have that sustenance, even if he has a pain, he goes to the work. He sacrifices for it. And he has the hardship he faces. He faces the hardship. On the other hand, there are some professions which are really having a lot of hardship in it. For example, when we see people working on the building a structure manufacturing a building or maybe manufacturing other things. There are many other things. There are many other jobs that requires hardship. So we see that the body is forced by the man, by humans, to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions. And even we can see, like, for example, the sportsmen, the bodybuilders, they are also forcing their body in order to have this hardship and to bear this hardship in order to fulfill the function that it has. Therefore, we see this over there, that this is how a person reacts when we look apparently at a person as a human being. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-purification as the agent of development. We said that we see that when a body is forced to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions and in order to provide the sustenance that it needs in order to have this world, or we need to spend a good life in this world, we put some hardship on ourselves. Same is the case with the spirit and the soul. And the spirit also must put up with pain and toil in the course of moral developments. If we want to have the moral developments, if we want to have spiritual developments, if we want to have self-perfection, it is necessary to put the spirit in the pain and the hardships in order to reach all these perfections or the developments that we are looking forward. All the various concepts and principles in the field of character building revolve around the axis of the soul or the spirit. It is spirit which is capable of reform and discipline. It is spirit which is capable of attaining sublimity and acquiring higher human qualities and excellences, loving as it does spiritual perfection. And finally, it is spirit which generates a series of ethical laws for the human being that the animal neither possesses nor requires. Therefore, it is necessary to have this hardship, the hardship of bearing, waking up on the time for the morning prayer, for example, the hardship of spending some money for the needy people, giving away some money as a charity. So all these things, we think these are the hardships, but these are the things that takes us towards the perfection, that helps us to gain the self-perfection. And the self-perfection is in giving away and in helping people and in building the good society with the good ethics, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
China launches 3 astronauts to its Tiangong space station as its construction enters a critical phase. The 3 blasted off from a launch center in northwestern China. They are the second group of astronauts to head to the space station since its construction began in April 2021. They will stay there for 6 months. The space station is planned as a 3-section structure. The core module was launched in April, and 2 more components will be sent into space in July and September. The new mission will oversee the integration of the 3 parts. The crew's commander has described the task as a pivotal battle in the construction of Tiangong, which is planned to be completed by the end of 2022.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to 2 more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found 2 additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil.
Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass-bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has curated these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A man in the city of Soran in Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region has become a local celebrity for a rather peculiar feature on his face. Hussein Abdullah Ahmed is famous for a record-breaking length of his mustache. Ahmed has been going by the name Mr. Mustache for decades now. His mustache has reached a length of 2.4 meters, making him a well-known man in the city he hails from. His son says, however, that his father's unusual feature is nothing new for him.
I've always known my father likes this since I was born. Although there were times when I had seen his moustache short, my dad is famous for his moustache, and we're proud of him.
Ahmed admits his moustache troubles him while working on the farm or trying to sleep, but to avoid the trouble, he either ties it from behind or stuffs it under his clothes. The 73-year-old man is not planning to get rid of his facial hair, which he hasn't trimmed since 1994. He seems to be enjoying the ride of fame as people stop him on the streets to take selfies with him.
The annual Vivid Life Festival has returned to Sydney after being cancelled 2 years in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event kicked off with fireworks and lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Iconic structures like the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia are part of a series of new canvases this time around. As an added treat, the 2022 festival also has the longest continuous light walk in the history of the event. Plus, this year's highlights include a choreographed light show by 600 drones. Both residents and tourists have been anticipating the return of this show.
I saw it about 8 years ago, I think, and it's just got better and better, as far as I can tell. I mean, the Opera House is the most amazing canvas possible to project, there's this amazing digital artwork, the vibrancy of it, the colour of it, the animation of it, the explosiveness of it, the colour just bursts out in just amazing ways, that the snakes, the chameleons, the lizards crawling across it.
The Harbour City will glow with 50 light installations, the projection artworks, as well as over 100 musical events. Vivid Sydney is an annual festival that lasts for 23 nights, infusing art, innovation and technology while collaborating with boundary-pushing artists. In 2019, the festival attracted millions of attendees. The event is owned and managed by the Tourism and Major Events Agency of the Government of New South Wales. Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have been beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by 6 centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4 meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial Alersi. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Boricevic is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street thanks to a billionaire class who holds a stranglehold over the governing political party, says Peter O'Born, author, in an article published under the heading Boris Johnson, the billionaire's useful idiot. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Welcome to British Politics This Overcast. A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street and determined to stay there. This is a recipe for, at best, paralysis, at worst, chaos. More likely both. It's hard to see what will make Boris Johnson quit. The prime minister, remember, has powerful allies. Tuesday's Daily Mail, Britain's most well-drilled and powerful popular paper, is an essential read for anyone wishing to understand the near-term trajectory of British politics. It contains a series of brutal hatchet jobs on former Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, Theresa May in trousers, who the Mail accuses of leading the plotters. On its front page, the Mail lacerates the 148 Tory rebels for pressing the self-destruct button by opening the door to smirking Starmer's coalition of chaos. The big newspaper prop writers, Murdoch, Rodermere, and the Barclay family, remain loyal to Johnson. Admittedly, the Times and the Telegraph are tougher than usual on Johnson this morning, but crucially, there are no calls for him to quit. Murdoch, Mail newspapers, and the Barclays are part of Johnson's core political base. They all backed him to be Tory leader, all backed him in the 2019 general election, and all have protected Johnson during the harrowing political scandals that have dogged his premiership. These newspaper magnates are still behind the prime minister today. While this remains the case, Johnson can hope to survive. The second half of the coalition backing Johnson are the billionaire Tory donors who funded Brexit and now, in a mutation of democratic politics, effectively own Johnson's Conservative Party. In an unprecedented direct intervention by the super rich in British public life, these donors came together in defense of Johnson. They wrote a letter significantly given as an exclusive to Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper, awarding their unconditional support to Boris Johnson. As the Sun emphasized, this letter was signed by some of the richest men in Britain, including billionaire J.C.B. Boss Lord Bamford, property magnate Sir Tony Gallagher, and Corfon warehouse founder David Ross. Other names reported The Sun include multi-millionaire financier Howard Shore and mega-rich Simon Rubin, who alongside brother David is worth £116 billion. The letter, which emphasized the talking points of Johnson's political campaign, announced that Johnson enjoyed the unwavering support of the billionaires who signed it. The authors of the letter seem to have felt no need to say out loud the unspoken threat that they would withhold funds from any Tory leader who dared to supplant Johnson. But the Johnson campaign team felt no such inhibitions. Johnson loyalist Nadine Dorries, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, went straight onto national TV and in a remarkable statement told Sky political editor Beth Rigby this: "The Conservative Party donors have said themselves that they aren't going to support the party if the PM is removed. I think a number of MPs in the marginal seats need to hear that and need to understand what they are doing. £80 million those donors have donated to the Conservative Party over recent times." We can only guess how many Tory MPs were terrified into supporting Johnson by this stark warning, amounting to an attempt at financial blackmail, that Tory donors would stop issuing checks if they voted the wrong way last night. But we can say for certain this was a dark moment in modern British democratic politics. A Tory cabinet minister setting out in stark terms that billionaires hold a stranglehold over the governing political party. We've never seen this openly stated by a senior active Tory politician before. This means it was a revelatory moment that, to redefine the way in which Johnson's premiership should be framed. So far, Johnson's many media allies have presented the Prime Minister as a cheeky chappy with common touch fighting a popular campaign against a distant liberal elite. Flawed for certain, a liar and a cheat, but always fighting for ordinary people. That claim has always been misleading. From the start of his premiership, ex-journalist Johnson has been the creature of the big media owners acting in alliance with deracinated financial capital. For all of his incompetence, falsehoods, and lack of vision, Boris Johnson still has their support today. Over the coming weeks, the British media will paint Britain's ongoing political crisis as the story of an embattled Prime Minister fighting a desperate struggle for survival. There is some truth in that dramatic, easily comprehensible narrative, but much greater forces are at work. The billionaire class put their man, Boris Johnson, in Downing Street 3 years ago. He suits them well because he does what they want. Johnson is at the apex of a system of government that hands out contracts, supplies favors, slashes regulation, attacks the rule of law, reduces the right of working people, and favors the marketplace above the state. The brilliance of Boris Johnson is that he does all of this while pretending to be on the side of ordinary working people. That's why the super rich love Boris, the billionaire's useful idiot. For all his faults, let's face it, Johnson was a shambles when he appeared on late-night British TV to declare victory after Tory leadership vote. Disheveled, gibbering, incoherent. This wounded Prime Minister blamed the media, shamelessly linked his fortunes to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and nonsensically claimed he had more supporters than when elected Tory leader 3 years ago. It made for painful viewing. Johnson has not simply lost the support of more than one-third of his parliamentary party. He's lost contact with reality, but not with the billionaires. The real story of the next few desperate months is not whether Boris Johnson, a truly wretched and discredited political figure, can survive. It's about whether the system of government, in the interest of the super rich he has come to represent, can be overturned.